Popular Front presents Skeleton Key, a monthly report on contemporary far-right militancy all over the world, only at patreon.com/popularfront. Today we speak to investigative journalist Peter Smith about the Nordic resistance movement. The NRM is a sort of jackboots traditionalist neo-Nazi organization that has in a way become a global conduit for the pro-Russia far right. So I first come across the Nordic resistance movement. It was 2014. So I was real young. I was 24 and I was out there reporting on Revolutionary Front, which was a very violent anti-fascist militant group in Sweden at that time. They were doing mad shit. Like, they would get the addresses of known neo-Nazis and literally go to their houses, smash through the doors with axes. Like, they were doing mad stuff, like throwing stun grenades into their homes, beating them in the streets. One of them stabbed a Nazi, like really hardcore stuff. So I made a documentary years ago about that. And as a part of that, we were out like kind of in Sweden. And then there was this not completely Nordic resistance movement march. It was kind of a little bit hidden in that sense. Like, they said it was something else. It was like, I don't know, Pegida or some shit at that time. But actually, it turned out to be like very heavily NRM. And I kind of didn't realize the extent to how prevalent they were then and are now. And I've been looking at your work and was like, okay, like, wow. So they're very organized. Anyway, that said, maybe you can just introduce them. Who is this group? What is the Nordic Resistance Movement?
So the Nordic Resistance Movement is a collection of organizations across kind of Scandinavia. Back in 2014, they were a little different about their beliefs, or a little less open about their beliefs, but they're very explicitly national socialist, like neo-Nazi organization. They were founded in Sweden, which is by far their largest branch, and they're still believed to be the largest far-right kind of militant organization operating out of the country. But they've spread to Norway, Iceland, Denmark. They had a branch in Finland, which was banned by their Supreme Court in 2020, but the former members still remain very active. They believe kind of the general neo-Nazi belief that the Jews are controlling majority of world events, that immigration is part of a global plot to replace and subvert white societies, and that ultimately things like the gay community, LGBTQ people, Muslim people are all inherently bad and eventually going to kind of wipe out the superior genes of the European.
So NRM, they're kind of, in a way, quite traditional in their national socialism, as it were. Not in the sense that, like, they're the same as Hitler, but it's kind of like the old jackboots-style Nazism where it come from, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, very much. They emerged initially kind of in the 90s after this group had fallen. There was a collective, like a decentralized collective, that was modeled after an American organization called The Order, that was made up of this, supposed to be this silent and nameless brotherhood of neo-Nazis. And inside of that group, this individual, Klaas Lund, he emerged from jail, very kind of prominent figure, known for robbing ammunition and weapons depot from the police and the military. And he saw that the organization called White Aryan Resistance had fallen apart, and came up with the idea instead to form a like extremely hierarchical, organized group just for Sweden. He called it the Swedish Resistance Movement. And it managed to kind of spread very quickly based pretty much on his street cred. They were absorbing other youth organizations at the time. And when he eventually would kind of get the shove out of the leadership, they rebranded as NRM under their new leadership, which turned them and kind of reimagined them as this new pan-Nordic organization that, as much as they view kind of in the racial hierarchy, viewing, white European people at the top of that, they also kind of explicitly believe that the Nordic man is somehow superior to all others. So as much as we see them kind of network and talk and support organizations outside of the Nordic bloc, they very much have this belief that They need to kind of stick with their own ethnicity.
It's a very specific thing, I think, to that region as well. Like, I've read through some of their stuff, and it's very, well, very Nordic, I guess you would say.
Yeah, very much. The other thing that kind of defines them is just how explicitly militant they are. The organization itself typically hasn't been found responsible for any of the attacks, but its members have carried out everything from targeted vandalism, attacks and violence with knives and guns, as well as a series of bombings that was attributed to some members that that received training abroad.
Weren't they associated with Michael Skilt years ago? He was a Swedish fella that went to Ukraine, one of the very first, if not the very first, far-right foreign volunteer, and he went out and joined up with Azov in like 2014. I actually spoke to him on the phone at that time when he was in Ukraine, and if I remember rightly, he was either very closely connected or actually a part of NRM.
I actually don't know the answer to that question specifically. It does seem like just about everybody in Sweden kind of touches their network to some degree.
Yeah, he was a super like slippery guy. I remember that.
It would certainly make sense. It's kind of like a proving ground. They have what they call nests, which are their local organizations throughout their countries of operation. And so, yeah, a lot of guys before they go on to other organizations or even become disillusioned with NRM will typically kind of stop off. It's almost like a kind of a touchstone of a lot of Nordic and especially Swedish neo-Nazis that pass through NRM on their way to other things.
Mm. What kind of militant attacks have they been linked to?
The list of that is quite daunting. As far back as the 90s, you know, there was the killing of a trade unionist in Sweden after he tipped off a newspaper that a fellow union official was active within the far right. So two members of what was then called the Swedish resistance movement did, and a third man with kind of more tangential connections to them faced weapons charges. There was a series of bombings that took place in Sweden against kind of migrant centers or asylum seeker centers that fortunately didn't kill anyone, but it did severely injure one individual. You know, during the anniversary of Kristallnacht at one point in Denmark, which was in the 1930s when Nazi Germany, when kind of German stormtroopers went out and smashed windows of Jewish-owned businesses, they kind of recreated that and desecrated a series of Jewish graves. The lists of assaults kind of are pretty extensive. There's been, I believe, three murders directly attributed to them, one of which in Finland, when one individual kind of objected to a protest that they were holding, he was assaulted by a group of them. And then when one guy kicked him in the chest, he hit his head on the cement, and several days later kind of died of injuries related to that.
So they're particularly known for violence. What is it? They kind of started out as a street gang and got more political or something like that. I remember there was some connection to bikers, if I'm right.
Yeah, very much. Initially, they were in the 90s. They were pulling together these kind of disparate youth culture of skinhead groups that would typically kind of connect through music. Swedish far-right culture in the 90s was really unique in the sense that you would read reports from that time and there would be individuals talking about, you know, the skinhead room at community centers where individuals would come together, you know, to share their tapes and their music. And they kind of bonded over that. A number of zines, one of which the founder wrote for, also kind of served as these like cultural touchstones of the far right. And then when Klass Lund emerged from prison and felt that there was a need to kind of pull all these individuals together, like I said before, he started absorbing these smaller remnants of this network he'd helped build before going into jail together, which ultimately he was able to form NRM. And he even went on to start, because he felt after getting pushed out, that NRM wasn't wasn't radical enough in its politics, and ended up forming another organization called Nordic Strike.
What happened to them?
They're still active. They're not as public as NRM. NRM's main exporter is definitely propaganda. They produce media and podcasts and video in all of the languages of the countries they operate in, as well as English. But yeah, they're still active. I was just checking with a researcher recently while I was working on a recent article about NRM. They're definitely smaller, but they're another kind of another organization that kind of continues this legacy of extreme militancy. I find it often kind of flies in the face of this idea that we have about some of the Nordic countries. But just as you were talking about what could be a very extreme anti-fascist organizations, you know, in some ways that is a reaction to an extremely active and militant far right.
Yeah, I mean, it was a real gang war at one point. I mean, I think the problem with Revolutionary Front is they just ended up all getting locked up. I mean, they were filming themselves smashing their way through Nazi houses. Also, they fucked up some shit, you know, like they threw like tear gas grenades into the window of like a young girl, like a child, you know, because a neo-Nazi lived there, but they threw it into the child's bedroom by accident or who knows, and like, you know, fucking terrorized this child for life as if her father's stupid politics is her fault. So I think a lot of that kind of got them shut down. But NRM is still very much active. How is it they were able to create this network all across the Nordic countries? Was it just online, or they actually like went out on foot and you know, met with these other groups?
Oh no, it is very much an in-person organization. As much as they have a lot of success, I think, exporting kind of these images of them, you know, marching through the streets, they all wear, you know, the same kind of pants and button-up shirts and ties, marching with these kind of green flags. They're very practiced at creating propaganda, but on the ground, they've and for a long time have been doing things that we see as kind of common within the neo-Nazi movements now. Things like hand-to-hand training, amassing weapons, you know, developing survival skills, almost like developing parallel economies in some ways. So that they're able to support their people. They were also just recently designated as a terrorist organization by the United States. But besides Finland, no other country that they actually operate in has taken that step.
Why is it America suddenly decided to do that?
That's an interesting question. I don't necessarily have a specific answer for it. Some of it may have to do with the war in Ukraine. NRM is explicitly pro-Russian in that regard. Ultimately, it seems like kind of the severe amount of violence that they've undertaken, the connections that they've been developing with American groups. Some members of Patriot Front chose to travel out there and kind of did a tour of some of the nests. But ultimately, the timing. Surprising. It did seem to come kind of out of nowhere. And since NRM doesn't really have any chapters within the United States, it's a little curious to see what the impacts of this designation might actually be. Certainly in the short term, their English language site has gone down. Some of their web presence has suffered. They used to take donations through cryptocurrency, which it seems like they've also pulled those links off of the websites that remain active. And part of this might just be that there's an economic component to the sanctions. Based on their posts on Telegram, all of the leadership of the organization basically lost their banking after the designation as well. And they were asking for cash donations and asked that actually, if anything that was a significant amount, they work out a way to have that delivered by hand. So despite, you know, being very far away and not really having any U.S. interests, it does seem like it's kind of hurt them to some degree. What the long-term effects might be aren't exactly clear. But, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how the policy aspect of that develops.
Do we know if they've got any members out there fighting for Russia in the DNR? I know there's quite a few fascists who've joined up with the separatist forces and are now basically just in militias that are kind of directly receiving weapons from Russia. It's a bit mad.
Yeah, that's a good question. I wrote an article recently about kind of a hooligan militia on the Russian side. I haven't heard of any NRM members directly. However, one of the guys kind of responsible for founding Rusich, Petrovsky, I think his name was, he had lived with an NRM member in Norway for a period of time. He's actually already been designated a security threat by both Oslo and the U.S. Treasury Department for his role in Ukraine since 2014, and was, I believe, arrested in Finland a couple of years ago.
So he was basically in connection with them at least.
Yeah. Like I said, it's an organization that there's only believed to be around 150, maybe 200 full members. They have a very strict kind of hierarchy and membership designation, but they used to be able to pull like 600-700 people out to their demonstrations. So there is this kind of tangential network of individuals that this individual very much seemed to be a part of. He lived with this one individual who was kind of very much a part of NRM Norway. So yeah, not necessarily a direct connection to Rusich, but definitely kind of networked in and very supportive vocally. Like they've made kind of, well, a lot of the far right can either be kind of just opposed to any participation, especially here in North America, can be opposed to any participation in the Ukraine war. It does seem like the vast majority of both the European and North American far right, at least rhetorically, support the Ukraine or support Ukraine. But NRM from the start has been explicitly pro-Russia in this regard.
Yeah, there's been a really interesting split both within anti-fascist scenes and fascist scenes in Europe, where they split either supporting Russia or Ukraine. Like both sides are doing it. It's very, very interesting, and has actually formed some really interesting and dangerous alliances that I think we'll see bear fruit in like the next 10 years in a very awful way. But that's by the by. Let's see what happens. Why is it that NRM chosen from the start with the pro-Russian side as opposed to being like pro-Ukraine?
Ultimately, they view Ukrainian society as controlled by the Jews. I mean, they view most of Western society that way. But it does seem like they very explicitly took that position to start out with. I don't know necessarily if it was just kind of a contrarian position to take. But they've had connections with the Russian imperial movement. Sorry, I just have a vehicle going by. They have connections with the Russian imperial movement that they go back to, you know, early into the 2010s. You know, RIM's leadership has you know, really spoke highly of NRM. They've done conferences together. And I believe it was two of the individuals who were responsible for the bombing campaign against the asylum centers and an encampment that was kind of serving as a home for some refugees. They had received training, including explosives training, at RIM's center in St. Petersburg, the partisan course.
So they were a part of that, some NRM people.
Yeah, they were, again, it was kind of this separation between the actions of its members and the group itself. It's like they had both been NRM members at a point, and then kind of their own volition, anyway, according to the courts, traveled to Russia to receive this training and then returned and engaged in I think they had planted three explosive devices by the time it had kind of come to an end and they were arrested.
Who's the current leader then of NRM, and how is he able to control different nests, as they're called, throughout the Nordic countries? Because as you said, they're like very strict on hierarchy.
Yeah, they have a national council that's led by Fredrik Vegeland, who's a Swede. He's been part of the organization since, like, for over 20 years, a very early member, very instrumental in growing the organization, and actually took over took over from Klaas Lund as he got pushed out. He is the one who took it from just being the Swedish resistance movement and blew it up into the NRM that we have today. He was named in the U.S. designation along with Par Oberg, who's believed generally to be the leader of its paramilitary wing, and then Leif Robert Eklund, who's another member of the National Council. So they have a National Council that kind of oversees broad policy for all of the nests, and then you'll have they have an International Council that kind of oversees the complete organization, and then individual countries will have their own councils. So very much a strict kind of governing body that makes decisions about them. All of their websites, or at least the ones that are still left up, typically have recordings, interviews, essays written by the leadership. So it's very clear just how these lines and which way the information kind of runs down from.
Tell us about this paramilitary wing they have.
I mean, it's part of the it's part of their ethos to train in hand-to-hand combat, to prepare for the kind of inevitable coming clash of civilizations. And it's something that they've done since very early on, is get their kind of members ready for hostilities. The actual kind of who makes up the paramilitary wing itself isn't explicitly public beyond the leadership, but it is it's something that they kind of, they are prepared for violence. They typically only say that to use it within self-defense, but whenever you read any of their documents or their manuals, it talks about how violence isn't necessary right now. Like that they're going to, they're primarily a political organization, but they're going to, they realize that at some point there's going to be like an end to the point where politics can be useful, and that they need to be prepared for that.
Interesting. Do we know if they've been doing like training with firearms? I imagine they have if they're claiming to be a paramilitary wing.
Yeah, they've definitely been amassing firearms. I haven't seen anything specific about the training, but you know, it is very much an active part of their belief system, and it may not be explicitly through NRM. I don't want to make any claims that I can't substantiate, but yeah, they fully understand that they need to get a hold of weapons and be skillful in using them.
How is it they're able to amass firearms? Like, I know that some of the Nordic countries are a little bit more open in terms of that, but you would think if they're like a member of a militant neo-Nazi group, the cops or someone would be like, hey, or maybe don't give them the guns.
Well, exactly. A lot of them are obtained legally. Most Nordic countries, you know, have provisions for hunting. Finland, especially when their group was active there, you know, every member essentially is kind of part of, or every citizen is part of the reserve force to some degree. But there have also been a lot of illegal weapons. You know, especially when you look at Sweden, like the 90s was such an interesting time. It seemed like there was a huge amount of bank robberies going on. There was a huge amount of, yeah, these far-right organizations obtaining weapons. And a lot of these things were sourced through thefts of military bases and police stations. Or police depots, I should say. So yeah, when you look at kind of the history of arrests over the past like 25 years, sometimes these weapons that they're catching them with, you know, they're illegal firearms, or they're legal firearms that they've obtained kind of through somebody. But ultimately, you know, when there's a will, there's a way. They're finding the channels that they need to get their hands on these.
Yeah, it's definitely not hard to get hold of a weapon or a gun, I should say, in Sweden, actually. They have that big problem with a lot of the Balkan weapons coming over the border, over the bridge from Denmark, which has got so bad that I think they've had to close it down temporarily. That's why you got all these gangs in Malmo, just firearms absolutely everywhere. Like, they have very lax laws on it as well. Like, I think it's changed now, but like, I have heard of stories where people have been caught with the gun but no ammo, and the police have been like, okay, well, we're going to take the gun, but, you know, off you go. It's just kind of nuts. I guess a perfect position for these people, unfortunately. You spoke earlier about the very strict hierarchy of like membership, and they only really have like, you know, just over 100 like specific members. What is that? Like, how is it that they are able to kind of keep it going with such strict ways of becoming a member? And what does one have to do to be in that fold?
Participation, it seems like, is the ultimate way to hold on to your membership. Like, there are vetting processes. It's almost in some ways similar to a biker gang. Like, you have hangarounds, you have kind of associates, and then you'll have your full members. Full members are required to show up to demonstrations, required to participate in meetings and training. It's interesting because when we look at a lot of modern far right groups, you know, there's a heavy focus on decentralization, on having it so, you know, plausible deniability of the actions of one individual can't necessarily be tied to an organization or a group. Whereas NRM has very much held on this idea that, you should be a participant, you should be members, you need to be active, or else you can kind of lose your status and access to some of the individuals. And as much as, you know, they are still, as much as they're very visible and they are, you know, still very fringe, despite that, they've had a lot of success in building kind of a culture of young men. Especially who are very interested in showing up and marching and participating. And then, like a lot of other organizations, we see them very much kind of glom on or focus on, you know, current issues as a means of staying relevant and getting attention. You know, they will protest outside of Israeli embassies or march outside of synagogues. Anything really that is kind of the issue du jour, they'll take up and give their particular viewpoint on and push out to people through their, you know, various media outlets.
Right. And these guys have been around for a long time, even without adapting their kind of aesthetic or even ideas very much from what I've seen. I remember seeing talk of NRM on like Stormfront years ago, and they're still around with the same logo. Why, like, how is it that they've managed to keep this presence? What is it they actually want that seems to be so, I guess, has this like neo-Nazi longevity in the underground?
That's another good question, because yeah, they were endorsed on Iron March as well as being kind of a supported group. What that actually meant wasn't ever fully clear, but, you know, members were active on the forum. I think that they have kind of tapped into something that is present in a lot of countries, like a very kind of present ethnic and national identity. That the Nordic bloc, you know, kind of has a unique iteration of, like, their own kind of take on their idea of a heroic past. It's difficult to say like why NRM specifically. It certainly seems like there has been a bit of a drop in membership and even some splits over the years that have diminished their capacity. Like, I don't want to downplay anything, but I certainly would be surprised if you ever saw 600 people show up to an NRM protest, this year. I think though that, yeah, they've really kind of excelled at bringing people in, you know, giving them a purpose. You know, things like propaganda runs, training, that can be really inspiring to individuals, especially people who are kind of looking for belonging. This was a number of years ago now, but I started my career here in Canada, like joining neo-Nazi groups and, you know, writing about them eventually. That kind of reached an end. But yeah, when you would talk to these guys, getting guys out to put up posters or going to demonstrations and things like that. It was a tool of kind of giving people accomplishing tasks that they could finish and accomplish, and then shared connection, you know, combat training, you know, unique kind of ideology and language, and all of that kind of comes together. And I think NRM, kind of since 1997 when they were founded, has always kind of excelled at bringing people together under that flag, as well as, of course, a literal flag that they wave just about any chance they get.
Mm. In terms of this this hatred they have for Israel, that's not new. That's not just because, obviously, of the war in Gaza. They have like a very, very serious, enduring hatred of Israel, obviously, because, you know, the NRM is neo-Nazi. But they also extremely, extremely hate Muslims. What is going on there? Is it they just hate Israel because they're Jews, or do they have some kind of, I don't know, some kind of connection to the more militant aspects of the Palestinian resistance?
You will see support for Palestinian resistance in their rhetoric, certainly recently. Yeah, it's true. They've always been considered themselves an enemy of Israel because of it being a Jewish state. They view it as impacting the policies of all countries. And then, much like you see in other kind of organizations, they view any type of Muslim immigrants, Muslim refugees, asylum seekers as being invaders, or as being like a tool of the Jews in themselves, that the Jews are trying to flood Europe with people to kind of dilute the white race. It's something that has been kind of a feature of the organization since before its outset. But I mean, it's, right now you'll see a lot of kind of protest action based around the current issues. There was even some weird articles where they talk about how most of the crimes being committed by Muslims in Sweden are being done by secular Muslims, and that they don't, they'll do this kind of lip service thing where they say they actually don't have any issue with people as long as they stay out of the Nordic region.
That is a really old school and interesting angle to that. Like if you read, for example, that book, like Homeland by Nick Ryan, there's a part there where I believe he actually goes there. He's in Lebanon where Combat 18, you know, the British neo-Nazi movement was invited to like a Hezbollah rally and like a seminar, and they're there and they all really get along because they're like, well, yeah, you stay here and we'll stay there and we'll all hate the Jews together. Like, it's quite an old school thing. It's really weird that the NRM has kind of held on to all of this. Not that other groups have not also held on to that, but they seem to be, I don't know, they almost, the way they present things seems to be kind of like very stuck in the past, but at the same time they've had this longevity. It's really interesting to me.
Well, they get very good at talking out of both sides of their mouth, you know, kind of cursing Muslim people as invaders. It is, you know, this raping scourge that is like sweeping across Europe. But at the same time, speaking of them as victims, you know, and yeah, like I said, paying kind of at least a lip service or like some type of tacit support for Palestinian resistance. It'd be interesting to see if they ever did receive an invite to travel anywhere. They travel in the past. Like I said, they're very into networking with individuals. They've been to Russia. The host of their English language podcast traveled to the UK to give a speech with the Patriotic Alternative. So I think that they understand that they need to have support kind of abroad where they can get it or spread their message however they can. But it is funny, they really do reject any idea of immigration, even from other seemingly European countries.
Yeah, I think they're quite specific in that regard. That's interesting though, they have all these kind of agents traveling all over the place to forge connections. Do we know what the Patriotic Alternative meeting was about, or joint speech, whatever it was?
It was like a larger conference, all of which was recorded and then later released publicly, except for the speech by the guy from NRM, which, you know, remains kind of hidden from the public to this day. So what explicitly was discussed, we don't actually know.
Interesting. I can probably imagine. It's funny as well, because Patriotic Alternative, mate, I haven't checked in for a while, but like last I saw, they were trying to like skirt away from this idea that they're actually neo-Nazis, whereas if you have a joint thing with the NRM, very clearly you're a neo-Nazi, you know what I mean? Or at least a huge sympathizer.
Very much. And NRM used to be that way to a degree. After they had rebranded, there was some time where they kind of denied a bit that they were nationalist socialists, whereas now it's just an outward position. They might reject the term neo-Nazi, but they're very clear that they support this idea of at least the politics that govern Nazi Germany.
What do you think changed?
I think there was just so much that it was a bit silly to try to continue to deny it publicly. This was a number of years ago, but certainly it seemed like there's just so many kind of overt and clear connections, both in their political writings, in their activism, and ultimately maybe it just freed them up to be a little more open with their audience.
Yeah, definitely. I think the more harder you lean into the extremism these days, it builds a bigger network, unfortunately.
There was also kind of, I think, there was an idea for a while that they might be able to engage with mainstream politics a little more substantially. They did get some, I think they got two or three individuals elected to kind of very local municipal government. First, there was a write-in candidate. They got one of their senior members elected in Sweden. And then after that happened, they filed as a political party, or attained status as a political party. Which they still retain to this day. Like NRM is a political party in Sweden, but they haven't really been able to kind of recreate that very limited electoral success that they managed to have before. There was even a guy recently in Finland, the day before the U.S. came out, who was a former member of NRM, who he stabbed a 12-year-old. Immigrant boy, and attempted to stab another at a shopping mall. He at some point, I believe, had run for some type of office with a far-right political party. So they do have these political aspirations, even though they do seem not to be able to realize them.
Yeah, and then they just go mad and like stab somebody. It's surprising though that they haven't been nailed down as an organization. They're obtaining weapons, firearms, they have a paramilitary ring, they do training, combat training, arms training, and yet still, okay, America's designated them a terror group, but it seems that they're kind of still head above water in the Nordic regions. Why is that?
I think ultimately it's that the criminal actions of its individuals have not been explicitly linked back to the organization. Like, I personally think it's a bit ridiculous at this point. Like, you may not be giving orders, but the actions of individuals are kind of spelled out within their writings and philosophy, and they don't make really any efforts to hide that. But yeah, I think that law enforcement within the Nordic bloc, again, with the exception of Finland, which has banned them, tends to focus on them as a criminal organization and deals with their kind of criminality piece by piece.
Yeah. Do they actually say, like, in their texts, like, do they say outright, like, go and attack someone, or are they kind of just alluding to that?
That's an important distinction, actually. They don't explicitly say that. They certainly advocate for aggressive self-defense, I think is the term they use most commonly. They talk about a time, though, where violence will become necessary, but will always pull back before saying, like, you know, now is the time, you know. So it's prepare for violence. Violence is coming, but no, not yet.
And when these people, like, linked to them, do commit violence, are they then venerated or seen as like a martyr or a saint, as they would call them in the kind of far right lingo, or are they kind of ignore it before we get arrested, or what? Like, do they celebrate them?
They usually don't ignore them. Usually they kind of recast the circumstances of what happened. Again, Finland is probably the best example. Like the individual who, was objecting to their protests. When you read their account of it, he attacked them. He assaulted them. I think there was some claims that he had spat on them, or something like that. But yeah, they'll take the event. They'll acknowledge it, but then through their lens of justifying the action. But yeah, you don't typically see kind of disavowals or real attempts to distance themselves from individuals, even when the Christchurch shooting happened. They were releasing writing, not explicitly endorsing it, but saying how they could understand how an individual might come to that point.
That's interesting. Yeah, they're skirting very carefully around the edge. I mean, it's quite a Nordic way to be, actually.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it. But yeah, I think they, whether it's just by sheer luck or whether it's deliberate, they've gotten very good at, just coming right up to the line of what would be considered incitement or endorsement.
Who are their allies in Europe then? Because they're very pro-Russian, which excludes certain far-right groups, and then obviously includes others. Who are their allies here?
The Golden Dawn was a big one when Golden Dawn was banned initially. Oh yeah, they held big demonstrations in support when Golden Dawn was initially banned or when its members were first starting to be arrested. More recently, it's interesting, some of their kind of more recent political opinions have alienated them from some far right movements within Europe. Patriotic Alternative, like I mentioned, here in Canada, we have kind of a far right network of white nationalists called Diagonal, that they appear on each other's podcasts and things like that. It does seem like anybody who can kind of line up with them to a reasonable degree, they're willing to engage with tacitly. They don't do a lot of joint action. Like I said, they're not really interested in making change outside of the Nordic bloc, but they will voice support for organizations kind of the world over that they see as fellow travelers.
So they've got this kind of like jackboot traditionalism, like the ideology, but they're still very influential. Would you say they're like influence within other fascist groups, and the fact they've been around for so long and are still active, is that like the biggest danger?
I think within Scandinavia, there's still very little doubt that they're kind of the top dog. Like there's nothing really that's risen to kind of offer a parallel within them. And so, like I said, you'll see individuals kind of pass through them, even if they don't stay. It's very unusual for individuals within the far right. Especially, maybe a younger generation, it's becoming less common, but especially within the past, 10, 15 years, just about everybody at some point kind of dips a toe into NRM to some degree.
It's kind of like a jumping off point.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Obviously, they're pro-Russian, and everybody always says that anything pro-Russian is directly funded by the Kremlin or whatever. It's like the new, it's kind of the liberal call sign is like it's Russia, Russia did it. But in this case, I can very much actually maybe think that is legit, that they might have direct connections to the state. Particularly other far right groups in Europe have had funding and stuff like that from the Kremlin. Do we know if there's anything like that going on with the NRM? Are they like directly linked at all, or is it just they are friends with the fascist groups there?
I would be really curious to see where some of their crypto donations have come from. There was a donation made by the leader of the Russian Imperial Movement. Like I said, he talked about it in a speech. There's some kind of equivocation over how much. It may have just been a few $100s, but yeah, I mean he admitted it fully as well as they talked about receiving it. But as far as like direct or indirect funding from the Russian state, I haven't seen anything substantial that I could kind of definitely put my finger on, but it certainly wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, and I think the RIM has had pretty close connection to the Kremlin in the past. I don't see that that would have changed.
Yeah, that's an interesting dynamic as well, kind of how these, yeah, how those organizations are supported by the Kremlin, while sometimes disagreeing or yeah, not fully aligning with their talking points.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. There's a great documentary called Credit for Murder. I'm always going on about this doc, but it's a really good documentary about Russian neo-Nazism, and it starts with an investigation into the young, well, he was believed to be an immigrant, but I don't think he even was. He was just like I don't know, like a native Russian lad with dark skin, and he was beheaded by a neo-Nazi group. And then through that investigation, you see a lot of very strange connections to Russia. In fact, very weird neo-Nazi Russians that ended up then skipping and joining Azov and like even running chapters of Azov. There's like a very strange mix of state-backed neo-Nazism going on there. So yeah, I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me if NRM has some kind of connection there, especially if they're in bed with the RIM. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that documentary, but I'll check it out. I mean, Russia has its fingers in kind of a lot of, sinister pies. It's interesting kind of up in who they network with, and then just where the movement goes as well. Like I said, even some of these kind of hoodlums in or hooligans fighting in the Espanola division, they're explicitly, pro Wagner, or yeah, a lot of times are have they support more this idea of like an imperial Russia than they do the Kremlin. So they'll be disagreeing publicly, but ultimately still kind of serving the same master.
Yeah, that's interesting. More of a like White Russia type thing.
Yeah, very much.
So you've written this report or on the NRM. Tell us about that.
Oh yeah, so the CTC Sentinel. When they were designated a terrorist organization by the US, yeah, it seemed like an opportunity to kind of put all of this history and everything about them that I've been watching unfold over the past kind of 5, 6 years into something, and an excuse to dive really deep into their writings and yeah, their history and their origins. I'm really fascinated by extremism in a lot of places, but specifically within the Nordic bloc, because it has this reputation for being this very kind of demure and polite society, but has just very extreme when it comes is very extreme when it comes to its radicals and its radical movements. Finland, in particular, is NRM has been, or when they were active there, some of its members were extremely violent. They had a recent plot. Or an alleged plot of individuals looking to commit attacks. I believe a couple of them were connected, again, kind of tangentially, or were former members of NRM. So it just seemed like something that not only was having a moment because of the designation, but a history that really needed to be kind of laid out in as full or in as much space as they'll give me in a magazine article.
Yeah. And in terms of like just to kind of like reiterate the beginning exactly of NRM, how was it that they were able to form like was there like a catalyst where they're like, right, this is what we're gonna do? Like what's their lore as it was?
Yeah, Klaas Lund kind of emerged from jail, where this big network, the White Aryan Resistance, in Sweden had fallen apart. They had hoped to be this kind of silent brotherhood, of disconnected individuals and cells that were building a culture. And he'd obtained kind of a celebrity in jail. He was an extremely violent man. He was convicted in the 80s for an individual had intervened with basically him and some others attacking some immigrant youth, and he beat one of them to death. He became this kind of folk hero within their movement. And then when he stepped out of jail, this thing had kind of essentially fallen apart and was just this very kind of small shell of what it had been when he went in. I think he kind of capitalized on a moment of individuals kind of looking for some type of organization or some type of outlet within the far right. And yeah, he managed to build a very strong, very militant organization within Sweden. And then when he was pushed out, the new leadership saw it as an opportunity to unite all of Scandinavia, to kind of bring their ethnicity together across these borders that they didn't necessarily view as being legitimate or as being of benefit to their movement. I mean, the whole region was like really decimated, by World War II, by the Nazis. So it's interesting to see just how virulently the individuals who managed to hold on to that ideology came together. But yeah, in their own story, I think going from the Swedish resistance movement to the Nordic resistance movement was viewed as kind of this inevitability of this thing that has to happen in order for them to achieve their victory. And that them holding on to this idea of being the voice of the legitimate voice of the neo-Nazi movement within Scandinavia has been something that they've really kind of beat into their members, and then something that is very much reinforced by the press as well.
He must be getting on a bit now, the leader.
Yeah, a little bit, absolutely. I mean, it is a little startling to me that Klas Lund is still around, considering his age. And then, yeah, even Vegeland, the current leader of NRM, they're not necessarily young men. What was interesting is there was a Swedish newspaper did an investigation and found that a good chunk of them receive benefit from the state. So besides the donations or whatever that they receive for the organization, they're essentially receiving social money or welfare money, which allows them to continue to do this to some degree because they don't need jobs.
So they get the money from the state, from the benefits, from the very state that they want to topple.
Yeah, exactly. They can't work for the state because it's infiltrated and subversive, against their cause, but they can take benefit from them.
All right. Well, I guess if it makes sense if you're like, just take what you can, but it's also kind of funny as well. Isn't there like legitimate political parties, far right, but like still like legitimate political parties in Sweden that have been like loosely associated with them?
Yeah, typically they'll find some of the Swedish Democrats, I think, have had a couple scandals where individuals either in political offices or candidates have had some connection or being viewed as too friendly. But we've seen to some degree very significant gains for legitimate far-right politics within Europe. So yeah, I do think that those kind of connections need to be continued to be unpacked more and understood, especially as it seems like there was a real threat of some of them rising to power.
Yeah, I just find it really interesting that they're still like the dominant fascist group in Europe, and then if you look at their iconography and all of their aesthetics, I mean, it's embarrassing. Like, it's very cringe, but still they have a lot of young members as well from what I'm seeing, especially with these parades where they're wearing like these white shirts, they got a black tie. Like, what the fuck is that, like traditional Nordic dress or something?
No, I don't think so. That is the traditional NRM uniform. It certainly hasn't, but yeah, they very much kind of look like cubicle dwellers or something. It's a bit of an odd uniform choice.
Yeah, like absolute dorks. I see them though, I see them like celebrating like Soleimani, like things in Iran and like Hamas leaders. So they've definitely, I think, branched out in that sense since I last looked at them.
Oh yeah, they're very politically aware. Like I said, anything that they can kind of touch on that they think will lend them legitimacy or yeah, something that might potentially draw in prospective eyes or even media attention. Like they're incredibly adept at getting the attention of especially local, certainly, and international media. And part of that is just again, as much as they look like dorks, a number of individuals marching through the streets, putting out their own images and their own propaganda, like, that translates to something in the media that they you can't necessarily quantify, but it's like, yeah, that they've just kind of proven their ability to get coverage and continue to get coverage. And I'm certainly not suggesting that we ignore them or that journalists shouldn't talk about what they're doing. It's like the it's what journalism absolutely should do. But yeah, they definitely have become skilled at using the attention to their benefit.
Yeah, definitely. I can imagine them getting swept up though if there was a younger group. But like you said, I think a lot of this comes down to their strict hierarchy, like what you were talking about, and the kind of traditional, well, if you're, I guess, like, unfortunately, if you're smart enough in the way they have in a country with liberal enough laws or loose enough laws where you can literally run a neo-Nazi militant group but have enough space between you and the people that do the militant stuff, the most violent stuff, and keep a tight hierarchy, that's in a way probably more useful if you're smart with it, which unfortunately they are, than actually running this kind of horizontal lone wolf type thing. Again, if you have a close-knit group, which unfortunately these guys really seem to have.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that they're very good at kind of keeping their core close, and that the most violent action, with a handful of kind of notable exceptions, has been carried out by individuals who have moved on, including like an absolutely wild chase, like a and in one in former NRA member stole an ambulance in Norway. And led police on a chase where they were like firing at the tires to try to get it to stop, and eventually crashed the vehicle into a gate. And yeah, it's they just have this incredibly like daunting history of connected individuals who go on to commit violent acts, or members who seemingly independently commit some type of violence, and that. Maybe it's an unwillingness by the state to step in, or maybe the final pieces just aren't there. But it'll be interesting to see with their ban in Finland and Finland now being part of NATO, if that impacts kind of the standing of NRM in any of the other countries that they operate in.
I think as well, there's this unfortunate draw still with a kind of well-organized movement because of the pure lack of organization and many internal dramas and very short-lived militant Nazi groups in Europe and America. I think maybe there's something to the NRM where they can be like, well, look, we've been here this long and we're still at it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's an interesting point as well. I mean, I do assume that something else will kind of come and supersede them at some point. Like, they benefited greatly from absorbing youth movements when they were first starting out. That ultimately, like, youth movements will end up being some type of future for whatever the far right kind of grows into in Sweden. But yeah, I also tend to kind of worry about that period of time because NRM's goal right now, at least tangentially, is to engage in legitimate politics. When they choose to leave that behind, or whatever comes next chooses to leave that behind, it might be a lot more kind of hostile or a lot more active than what we've seen already from a group that has, or from a group whose members have committed a great deal of violence against their perceived enemies.
Just randomly, last question. Do we know if they were talking at all about Anders Breivik? I ask because that's like a very obvious Nordic type far right lunatic. Not so far away from them. I can see them, you know, having a lot to say about that. Did they talk about it publicly?
Not that I'm aware of. Commented on him because they tend to comment on legitimately everything. But not that I've seen in my research.
To be fair, he was. Well, at the time, he was a Zionist, like an ultra Zionist. Now I think he's changed his moves to like full on neo-Nazism. But he was an ultra Zionist when he did the attack. I remember reading his manifesto and various things that he wrote. But yeah, anyway, fuck him. Fuck NRM.
That is my official stance, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. What's the best way to get hold of you, mate, and look at your work if people want to?
Yeah, I write a huge amount about Canada. At antihate.ca. My Twitter handle is a bit ridiculous, but it's Mystery Pete, like MISTER, the letter E, and then Pete, my name. And then, yeah, I do a lot of independent research and freelance. So I typically will appear just about anywhere that'll take me.
Yeah, I'll put the link in the description as well.
That'll probably help. Thank you.
Yeah, no worries. All right, mate. Thank you so much. Really appreciate that.
No, it's my pleasure.
That was Skeleton Key, a popular front project focused on contemporary far-right militant groups. Music by Sam Black, sound mix by Splicing Block. If you pirated this episode, alright, but please consider supporting at patreon.com/popularfront. We are entirely independent, grassroots conflict journalism. No one owns us, no one has a single share, and we do not take money from bastards.